If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why do we believe in these things? Well, we always believe stories. I mean, honestly, you and I have heard stories from childhood. We read them. They're called fiction. And yet, because they represent life in a way that it is very similar, and that is based in very similitude, they gain truth. Now, what is truth? Who knows?
You're listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling Science and Technology Monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.
Hello, this is Alexander McNamara, and I can assure you that I am telling you the truth when I say that I am the online editor of BBC Science Focus. However, were I to tell you that I was a Premier League footballer or an Oscar-winning movie star, you would probably quite rightly guess that I was telling you porkies. We all love a good story, and sometimes a lie is more interesting to hear than the truth, but there is plenty more to it than spinning a good yarn. According to linguist Marcel Denasi, throughout history, certain liar princes have perfected the art of lying to gain fame, fortune, and notoriety. In this week's podcast, he explains what makes them so effective at this so-called Machiavellian intelligence, what happens in the brain when we twist the truth, and why we're all liars in one way or another. He starts by explaining to our online assistant, Sarah Rigby, what a liar prince is and why they're so good at manipulating the truth.
Yes, the name comes from Machiavelli's The Prince, which is, as far as I can tell, the first ever manifesto, or at least treatise, on the art of lying. And now, you do have before that philosophers and certainly religious people who have dealt with lying. I mean, all you have to do is go back to the Bible, right? And Lucifer is the first great deceiver who brought down humanity with a lie. You have St. Augustine, the 4th century Christian theologian, who wrote an actual mini treatise on the types of lying. But never before in history has they had a manifesto, as far as I can tell, being written in which aspects of lying and how to deceive people, why they should be deceived, how easily duped people are by the what later on Hitler called the big lie. There's never anything like it. So I use the term liar prince because we're all liars. I mean, we all lie for whatever reason it is. But there are some people who are masters of the lie, those who have a particular talent and who hone it and develop it and use it as a constant discourse strategy. That's who the liar prince is. So it comes out of Machiavelli.
So what might a liar prince use their skills to try to achieve?
In my own book, I go actually through the 200 pages to show historically how this is done. So there's a long answer, which I'm sure nobody wants to listen to, but there's a short one. We all know what lies do. What the liar prince also knows as well as we do, that they can harm. We don't want to really harm. And, you know, little white lies, it's for us to avoid, some consequence. If I say to my wife, I did mail the letter and then I hadn't, and I know I would do it the next day, it's to avoid, a temporary infelicity of interaction. However, if I wanted systematically to, I don't know, I'm envious of a colleague. I wanted that colleague to fail. then I would start a mythology, a story. They call them conspiracy theories. The more appropriate term is confabulation, and build on it and build on it until some effect will happen. Machiavelli knew that if I do this constantly, not everybody can be, well, will be, you know, affected by it, but a lot of people will. So it's a matter of situation, the context. A lie could be truth in another context. And the audience, the people to whom you aim the lie, and the others whom you want to affect. That's the liar prince. The strategies are enormous. Deception, dissemblance, making up stories, BS, and on and on and on. In my own book, I actually go through historical examples of how these have affected history. In my own view, we rarely take into account that lies, deceptions, have affected history probably more than truth. And it's the attack on truth and the quest for truth that finally determines historical outcomes. Now, you start with Odysseus. You know, Homer absolutely knew that liars get things done, for the better or for the worse.
So can you give some examples of these historical liar princes?
Well, you know, before Machiavelli, there were mythical creatures, mythical figures, I should say, and some historical figures. Machiavelli himself gives the examples of several popes who were very strategic at using the mendacity. I'll call it the Machiavellian art, because it is a Machiavellian art. But if you go, you know, mythical figures, Dolos, the mythical figure of ancient Greece, who got ahead by lying and eventually by faking things. By the way, there were fake news in antiquity as well. In other words, creating myths that were not true but believable because they had some very similitude in it. But the most salient examples are from modern history. Think of the Orwellian states, starting with Stalin and the Soviet Union, working your way through Hitler in Germany and Mussolini in Italy, and they were founded on lies. Hitler's lie was that of the Aryan myth. Everyone says there must have been an Aryan race. There was not. I'm a linguist, and what there was an Aryan dialect of an Indian language related to Sanskrit. And people in the 19th century, the early linguists, the so-called philologists, knew that this was a dialect, but it did not constitute a separate race or certainly a separate state. And in fact, one of the linguists of that era, his name was Friedrich Müller, not making his name up, wrote that anybody who says that Aryans were a race is a liar. And there you go, a mythology. And in fact, it is not coincidental that Hitler and the Nazis used the swastika, which is a sacred symbol of that area. So they tapped into a confabulated mythological history, created it, and made it believable. Guess what? People still believe it to this day. If you put things in the form of a narrative, and that narrative seems to tap into a belief or a hidden belief that you have, including a resentment or some kind of bias, then you will believe it.
Why is it that you would say that we are so susceptible to these grand lies given to us by these liar princes?
If I knew that answer, I would be a rich man because I could find the serum, the antidote to it. I do have some ideas. Our brain is a strange brain. It's got the neocortex where logic, language, mathematics, art, aesthetics, it's all there. But below it is the limbic system. And there is one theory called the theory of Machiavellian intelligence. I didn't make this one up either, that says that when lying emerged in our species and in other primate species, it did show a survival strategy because those who were the better liars, I'm reducing it somewhat, were better able to survive in their territory because they outwitted competitors for food, for procreation, and so on. Okay, so it's probably built into our brain, but it's not a logical, what the Greeks call logos. The Greeks beautifully divided cognition into two areas, logos, which is where language, reasoning, argumentation, etc. reside. It could be, it could correspond to the left hemisphere of the brain. I'm not completely convinced. And then mythos, where we imagine things, where we try to connect ourselves in a kind of metaphysical drama in the world. Once you tap into mythos, and that's what I point out, for example, in the case of a Hitler or even of a Trump, once you tap into it, there's almost no way out. The example I'd like to give is a childhood. I was told that Santa Claus was real. And you know what? I believed it. I absolutely believed it. When I was then told that it wasn't and I grew up and figured it out, I was so disappointed. To avoid the disappointment, I came up with various strategies. The psychologists call it dissonance, cognitive dissonance. But eventually I caught on, of course. Now, apply that same model of reasoning into big lies, mythological histories like the Aryan myth. Once you tap in and someone will tell you it's not true or you have evidence before you, it creates dissonance. We do not like that. We will do anything possible to resolve that dissonance, coming up with excuses, and even finding the evidence against it as evidence for it. That seems to be the structure of our brain. It could well be in our limbic system. It could well be that beliefs are the strongest things we have. You know, popular culture has come up with figures like Dr. Spock, you know, in the Star Trek series, or Sheldon Cooper in the Big Bang Theory sitcom, that says if we could eliminate that aspect of the emotional system that can lead to deception, we would be much better off. Actually, we wouldn't, because a famous semiotician, Umberto Eco, good friend who passed away a couple of years ago, said that without lies, without deception, we probably wouldn't even have art, which is itself a huge lie, but makes us understand the truth. So if we want to understand the truth about what happened, for example, in Nazi Germany, we have to understand the lies behind the way it was created and generated.
I was really interested to read in your book about the power of confabulation.
Yes.
And I was quite surprised by the story about how confabulation helped the mafia to develop and gain power in Sicily. So could you tell us a bit about that, please?
Yeah. If I can give a little bit of a background, I was co-opted by an anti-mafia journalist who's my co-author of a book called Made Men. His name is Antonio Nicaso. I didn't want to do it at first because, you know, but then I started to realize how interesting it is. If you belong to a street gang and join it, and it's made on the spot, you need something to distinguish yourself from other gangs. One way to do it is to develop a system of rituals and of symbols that says, that's us, a language, a kind of criminal code that says we speak to each other. It's kind of a the walk, the talk, and the look. If, however, the criminal organization is steeped deeply in a society, as were the three Italian mafias, the Sicilian mafia named Mafia, the Calabrian mafia named the 'Ndrangheta, and the Neapolitan mafia named the Camorra. And I'm using these three because this is where the confabulation comes in. The story is told, made up completely, that these three versions of the mafia, they are rustic, chivalric organization, Cavalleria Rusticana. It's even an opera. It's actually a short story by Giovanni Verga becoming an opera, and it starts off the third episode of the Godfather series. They weren't noble, chivalric people, knights. They were rustic. They came from the people. In fact, it was said in one of their tales, which has then been enshrined in legends, urban tales that are told about the mafia, even songs is that there were three knights, three brothers, who saved, I could get this a little bit off because my memory is starting to fade on this thing that I did a few years ago, but it goes somewhat like this. They saved, I think it was their sister, from being raped. They got imprisoned by a nobleman. They got imprisoned. And when they escaped, these chivalric knights, one went to Sicily, another one went to Calabria, and a third one went to Naples to form these chivalric, these honorable societies. And they developed a code of honor. Actually, the word is omerta, which is both honor and virility and masculinity. In other words, they distinguished themselves from common street thugs with this code and this historical confabulation of who they are, from whom they've descended. They're not the only ones. The Yakuza in Japan and the triads in China and other organizations do exactly the same thing. They gain legitimacy. They gain honor from it, and therefore it imbues meaning in their rituals, their initiation rites, and even their lifestyles.
Right. And then because people choose to believe in these histories, it sort of gives them a sense of authority. Would you say that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You know, you asked me before, why do we believe in these things? Well, we always believe stories. I mean, honestly, you and I have heard stories from childhood. We read them. They're called fiction. And yet, because they represent life in a way that it is very similar, that is based in very similitude, they gain truth. Now, What is truth? Who knows? I mean, we make our own truth most of the time. One of the things that I found interesting in doing this book and in actually doing work on the mafia is that I have a completely new view of history. It's a matter of interpretation. It's not just relaying information and packaging it truthfully. It's what you select and you put it together, how it flows, and the better historians are the better storytellers. Now, I happen to like some of the histories better than others, but that seems to be our brain has narrative structure. I have no doubt about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And another figure from history who was great at using language to influence people was P.T. Barnum. Could you please give us a brief summary of who he was and how he used language?
Yeah. Now, as you know, I do devote a significant portion of my book to Trump, but not only. Discuss Trump's art of the lie because, well, he's right there right now, and he's a perfect example of the Machiavellian liar. But Trump is in the tradition of the huckster, the American huckster, who is half a preacher and half a circus or, showman entrepreneur. Now, P.T. Barnum was both. He was both a religious person, actually a strong supporter of prohibition and other things of that nature, but also at the same time someone who did contribute to charitable things, and also a huckster. I mean, the hyperbole that we hear so often, for example, in Trump's speech or in advertising, really does come from the tradition of P.T. Barnum and his circus, the greatest show on earth. Come and see it, spectacular events happening, all this hyperbole. Now, we all know that, in effect, that can't be, but we want it to be that way. We like hyperbole. We like huge and big things. And in fact, the bigger, the better. All of our modern mass cultural events, as the scholars at the Frankfurt School would point out, are based on this type of subtextual hyperbole. It's always bigger. It's always better. This is particularly so in America, and it is of no surprise that America has that tradition of P.T. Barnum esque language and pitch that people make about products. You see it in advertising. It is absolutely everywhere. What has scared me in doing this research, because I'm not much of an internet user. I don't go on social media, but I go and investigate them when I do work of this kind. it is imbued with this kind of discourse. I mean, it seems to me that a large portion of social media and other kinds of websites are based on hyperbole, on confabulation, and really, who cares? As long as you put it out there and people can buy it, you have sold your ideas. And that comes right out of the tradition of P.T. Barnum. You know, it was Herman Melville, who wrote a marvelous story on the con artist who would go on boats on the Mississippi and dupe people into doing things. And of course, it turned out that this con artist, this master Machiavellian liar, was the devil incarnate. So from the beginning of American history, there has been a fear and at the same time a worship of this figure, of this huckster, P.T. Barnum-like figure. Trump is just the latest incarnation of that type of figure.
So you've touched a bit on this already, but why do you think that right now it's important for people to be able to recognize the sort of liar prince figure?
I think we should, throughout history, eventually the lies get exposed. There's a marvelous Italian expression, lies have short legs. eventually they work out on their own. However, we're living in a lie right now. You have problems in Britain based on a lot of lying. And it's because of the issue of the lies are aimed at otherness. I grew up as a teenager in Toronto during the early rock and roll era, and then went to university during the hippie counterculture era. The whole idea was to make the world as inclusive as possible, to ignore differences of race, of gender, and of everything else that was around there. And when I first started teaching, my first university job was actually in the United States. It was in 1972, and I was teaching during the Watergate hearings against Richard Nixon. And I was teaching a course, exactly the same two courses I'm teaching now, one on Machiavelli and one on language and mind. And I thought it was done. It's over. People are going to accept otherness. Differences are irrelevant, right? Our tribal instincts are gone. Well, guess what? They have not. And I felt that I needed to bring this out. All I can do is describe it. Nothing else. I'm not a prophet. I'm not a politician. I have no solutions. I can only look at history. I can only show what has happened. And I particularly know a lot about language. Boy, did I learn a lot about how to lie with words, with metaphors, with slander, how to shape messages to make them effective. Now, having said that, if I wanted to be a Machiavellian liar, if I left this interview and said, I'm going to start doing it, I could not do it. It's not in me. So there is a talent. Some people are born to be musicians and they have to hone it. Some people are born to be liars. And there's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing we can do about it. But I thought that it was time for me, a linguist, to take up my shovel and unearth what's below the surface.
That was University of Toronto Professor of Linguistic Anthropology, Marcel Denasi, explaining the shocking truth about lies. His book, The Art of the Lie, How the Manipulation of Language Affects Our Minds, is out now. If you're more into facts than falsehoods, the new issue of BBC Science Focus is out now, where we'll be revealing the surprising science of self-control. Next week's podcast is with Samantha Algar, where we'll be talking about, bees. So subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and it'll buzz its way over to you as soon as it's released.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.